Hello, my name is Derek Mattson. I'm a dramaturg, translator, and a lecturer in performance studies at the University of Chicago, and I'll be talking here about George Friedrich Handel's opera Ariodante, first performed in London in 1735. Why was a German composer writing Italian opera for the British stage in the early 18th century? Before 1700, opera in London consisted mainly of court masques, mixes of dance, spectacle, and allegorical poetry that were half sung and half spoken. These English masques were different from the operas coming out of Italy at the time, which were all the rage across the continent and were sung all the way through without any spoken dialogue. A few enterprising theater managers in London after the turn of the century calculated that there was a great deal of money to be made by producing these newfangled, entirely sung operas on British soil, so they started presenting arrangements of Italian works. Some of these works were operas that had been Englished, which meant they'd been translated and were being sung in English. Others were sung in their original Italian. Others still were sung in both English and Italian at the same time. Casts were often mixes of English and Italian singers, and performers would just stick to the language they were most comfortable with. These productions didn't yield the kind of financial return that their backers had hoped for. It wasn't until a crafty impresario gambled on the profitability of star singers brought in from Italy that opera really caught fire with the London public. These Italian singers, and most especially the castrati, electrified London audiences with their dazzling musical capabilities. They generated not only unprecedented popular interest in opera, but also greater demand for more and more Italian singers. As casts increasingly filled with Italians and star singers stormed the London cultural scene, it came to be taken for granted that opera was sung in Italian. Enter George Friedrich Handel, who grew up in Halle near Leipzig and trained in Hamburg. During this time, Handel was steeping himself in Italian styles of composition. From age 21 to 24, Handel lived and worked in Florence, Rome, Venice, and Naples. His successes in Italy won him the appointment of Kapellmeister in Hanover, where his harpsichord playing was much admired by, as luck would have it, the German family soon to be installed on the British throne. Handel was invited to come to London in 1710, when he was 25, in order to compose the first new Italian opera written specifically for presentation in London. That opera, Rinaldo, opened the next winter and was a huge success. After one brief return to Hanover, Handel settled back in London in late 1712 and remained there for the rest of his life. The political situation in London at the time of Handel's arrival was essentially post-revolutionary. The governments that were established after the restoration of the monarchy in 1660 and after the Glorious Revolution in 1688 had not resulted in stable regimes. James II was successfully deposed in the Glorious Revolution for being Catholic, but his son was still looking to reclaim the throne. The prospect of a Catholic monarchy being restored by force hung heavily in the air during the first half of the 18th century. Parliament sought to obviate any such claim with the Act of Settlement of 1701, which decreed that, on Queen Anne's death, the crown would pass to a line of Protestant royals in Hanover. While it secured the nation's identity as a Protestant enclave, the Hanoverian succession was a much contested political issue. Many representatives of royal lines with far superior hereditary rights to the throne were passed over to secure the monarchy for George I and his family. During his first years in London, Handel was strategically used by the House of Hanover to smooth the way for their succession. Handel's cultivation of opera in London contributed to the image that the newly British royals sought to convey, an image that associated Hanover with elegance and cosmopolitanism. The opera in London emerged as a key gathering place for opposing political factions to come together and socialize. It served both a cultural function of endowing London with glamour and status, and a civic function of enabling orderly and enlightened discourse. Despite all this, attempts to sustain a permanent opera company in London, even with Handel at the artistic helm, collapsed again and again, opera then, as now, was incredibly expensive to produce, and no one seemed able to find the right formula for offering up the artistic and social experience that everyone expected while also keeping the books balanced. Part of the problem in London was that no royal family since the Restoration possessed the means to subsidize theater as lavishly as had been done before the Civil War. So, unlike cultural centers like Vienna, Paris, or St. Petersburg, where opera was bankrolled by absolute monarchs happy to write blank checks, opera in London was essentially a commercial enterprise, subject to the whims of the market and entirely dependent on ticket sales. Handel's artistic budgets were always precarious, but the season that brought forth Ariodante was nerve-wracking in a way no other had been before. Personal hostilities toward Handel had been mounting in society circles for some years. Handel was perceived as imperious and hubristic about his unquestioned position as the sole presenter of opera in London, at a time when musicians were largely regarded as servants. Detractors faulted him for being too cozy with the king and saw him as a symbol of the corrupt government that held the king's powers intact. Many objected to his music. They felt his music was tired, old school, passé. They resented that he had a stranglehold on opera production such that the form wasn't able to evolve or offer any of the newer stylistic developments that were coming out of Naples at the time. So, the knives were already out for Handel when, in the spring of 1733, he presented his oratorio Deborah and charged double the usual price for tickets. Audiences were outraged. Only a few weeks later, Handel had a decisive falling out with his lead castrato, the fiery but much admired Senesino, who had sung with Handel's company in London for 11 seasons. These many tensions culminated in the establishment of a new Italian opera company that was designed to give Handel a run for his money and was organized by a group of noblemen headed by the Prince of Wales. The hatred that the prince and his father, King George II, felt for one another was legendary. And since the king held Handel very dear, it shouldn't surprise us too much that Prince Frederick relished abetting this upstart company, which is known to us now as the Opera of the Nobility. The first shot across the bow from the Opera of the Nobility was to hire almost all of Handel's lead singers right out from under him, beginning with Senesino. They then proceeded to lure away Handel's best orchestra musicians. Handel pluckily reconstituted an entirely new opera company for himself, hiring a fresh raft of talent out of Italy, and the rivalry continued apace for a full season. The following year, 1734, the Opera of the Nobility made their next big move. When Handel's lease at the King's Theatre in the Haymarket was up in July, the Opera of the Nobility snagged the theater from him, forcing him to relocate to some other artistic home. Thwarted but undeterred, Handel signed a lease to present his next season of operas in the recently opened theater at Covent Garden. The Opera of the Nobility hit back by hiring none other than Farinelli, the greatest castrato of the day, and many say quite possibly one of the greatest opera musicians of all time. The pressure was on. Handel knew that he had to hit it out of the park with his new offerings that season, so he put more effort than usual into the composition of Ariodante, which he wrote between August and October 1734. The opera opened in January the next year. The libretto is a reworking of an older opera text from 1708, which itself was based on an episode from the Renaissance epic Orlando Furioso by Ariosto. One of the advantages of Covent Garden for Handel was that it also housed a ballet company under Marie Salé, a leading ballerina of the Paris Opera. Salé and her dancers were now available to Handel for creating ballets that could function both as extensions of the operatic story and as added attractions to help him compete with the juggernaut of Farinelli. As a result of his collaboration with Salé, each act of Ariodante ends with a ballet, a pastoral ballet at the end of the first act, a dream ballet at the end of the second, and a celebrational ballet at the end of the third. Now, before we jump into a conversation about the music, I'd like to say a few words about the conventions of early 18th century opera. Not unlike our Hollywood rom-coms or action flicks of today, opera in Handel's day also followed conventions that were familiar to the audiences of the time, and it's useful to keep those conventions in mind as you listen. So, if you're new to Handel, here's a quick primer, and if you're already a devoted Handelian or Handelist, then this is a quick review. The music consists overwhelmingly of solo arias. Big choral ensembles are rare, and for the most part, limited only to the closing moments. The same goes for duets. They're rare. Trios, quartets, quintets, etc., are nowhere to be found. Those develop out of a later moment in opera history. The plot of the story moves forward in recitative dialogue set to spare accompaniment, which is referred to as continuo, consisting of some combination of harpsichord, fiorbo, cello, and double bass. The arias are accompanied by fuller orchestral forces, and they're placed at the end of each scene. They represent heightened poetic moments of reflection, reaction, or emotional expression. Aria and duet texts normally consist of two poetic stanzas of equal length. The prevailing musical structure for setting the text is the da capo form, which means the first stanza is set to music in an A section, the second stanza is set to different music in a B section, and the song then returns to the beginning to repeat the A section with the singer adding ornamentations and embellishments. Most songs in Handel's operas are da capo arias that follow this A-B-A structure, though there are exceptions. Now, the convention by 1710 is that after a full-length da capo aria, the character who just sang has to leave the stage. There are times when Handel breaks this rule, but exiting was the norm. There are three acts, normally with one set change in the middle of each act, and the action takes place within a span of 24 hours. In this period of opera history, tragic endings are deemed unworthy of civilized societies. Libretto poets are expected to portray what should happen in a just, moral world, rather than what might actually happen. Theatrical realism is still a ways off. Murder is not permitted on stage. Death generally isn't allowed on stage at all, with one exception being a dignified death in battle. Finally, there's a hierarchy of singers within the opera companies of the time that determines how many arias each character gets. At the top of the hierarchy is the castrato, who always plays the leading man, then the prima donna, who plays his romantic interest. This principal couple would usually get 4 to 5 arias apiece, and at least one duet. Then there's usually a second-ranking romantic couple that gets 3 to 4 arias apiece, and so on down the line. There are times in Handel's operas when you might wonder why we're getting yet another aria when it seems a little extraneous or doesn't feel dramatically necessary. The conventions of the company hierarchy often necessitated compositional decisions that might feel a little inscrutable to us today. One last word about the casting. At the premiere in 1735, the hero Ariodante was played by the castrato Giovanni Carestini, and the villain Polinesso was played by the contralto Maria Caterina Negri in a trouser role. In lyrics production, we're gender reversing that casting. Ariodante will be sung by mezzo-soprano Alice Coote in a trouser role, and Polinesso will be sung by countertenor Yestin Davis. For the purposes of this conversation, I'll use the gender of the character when I talk about each one, rather than the gender of the singer to avoid confusion. On to the music. After a brief, darkly colored overture, we find ourselves in the boudoir of Princess Ginevra, the only child of the King of Scotland. Ginevra sits at her mirror, beautifying herself for the great love who has inflamed her noble heart, the vassal prince Ariodante. In the music, you can hear bounding triplets in the violins and voice that spill forth like ringlets of loosened hair or ropes of glistening jewels. It's sumptuous, breezy. This is a young woman in the thrall of love's full blush. As always with Handel, it's instructive to listen for the word in the song that gets musically elongated with vocal flourishes. These flourishes tell us a lot about who these characters are. Here, that word is vago, which means desirable or attractive. Ginevra says she wants to make her countenance more vago for her beloved. Musica, e prima. Into her boudoir enters Polinesso, the Duke of Albany, who is Ariodante's rival and himself in love with Ginevra. Ginevra spurns him and launches into an aria, telling him in no uncertain terms that she is not interested in his attentions. Listen to how the music communicates her contempt for this man. The tempo immediately shifts into a furious allegro, and Ginevra blasts off without any orchestral introduction or ritornello, as would have been customary for a da capo aria. The break from convention in the music is telling us that Ginevra's feelings for Polinesso are direct and categorical. There is no contemplative preamble from the orchestra before she tells him what she thinks. Listen, too, for the huge leap that Ginevra takes with her first word, pouncing a full octave from an F at the top of the staff down to an F at the bottom. The word she's saying here is orrida, meaning horrid. You're horrid to my eyes, is what she's saying to Polinesso. And the nosedive on that word is a real indication of her disgust for him. Gone are the twirling triplets and coquettish flourishes we heard when Ariodante was the person on her mind. Polinesso is left alone to hatch a plan that will undo his rival and win him the princess. As it happens, Ginevra's lady-in-waiting, Dalinda, is in love with Polinesso, and so he schemes to use her in his plot. Polinesso is a nasty one, quite possibly the baddest of Handel's baddies. Handel uses the key of C major for Polinesso's aria here, which is a very rarely used key in Handel's operas. It's an indication of how Polinesso exists apart from the community around him. It's also an indication of how singular he is in his deviousness. Polinesso sings here about the virtues of treachery and deception on a grand scale. Listen to how snappish the rhythms are and how slithery the vocal line is as it moves up and down the musical staff. Coperta da frode di nana servire si fugge di testa e this music is flippant, derisive. We can hear straight away how slippery and treacherous Polinesso will prove to be. Next, we meet Ariodante, who's outside in the royal gardens. The change of setting here underscores the contrast between our villain and our hero, as does the significant change of musical styles. Immediately with Ariodante, we hear a lush, orchestral texture gracefully evoking the ripples of a nearby rivulet and the flutters of birdsong on a pastoral oboe. Thank you. This is Ario Dante's domain, nature, wild open spaces, in direct contrast with Polinesso and the palace, which is associated with power grabs and intrigue. Ario Dante and Ginevra offer their hands to one another as a pledge of faith in a love duet. What's so interesting about this duet is how Handel interrupts it. Just as the lovers are beginning their repeat of the A section, the King of Scotland, Ginevra's father, interrupts them and prevents them from completing the song. Here's the tail end of the B section of the duet, followed by what should be the launch of the da capo repeat, getting derailed by the king. As he often does, Handel is manipulating convention here for his own creative purposes. That the king feels free to interpolate himself into this love duet indicates how strongly he approves of their union. At the same time, it serves a practical function for Handel. Again, the rule was that characters had to exit after a da capo song. By heading that da capo off at the pass here, Handel frees himself from having to script an exit for them, so the scene with the king in conversation with the lovers can just continue forward. For audiences in Handel's time, this would have been a delightfully unexpected break from the norm that would have grabbed folks' attention. The king orders that the royal trumpets make public the happy tidings of Ginevra's upcoming wedding to Ario Dante. Now, let's just observe that the word the king uses in this aria, tromba, does in fact mean trumpet, even though Handel chooses to score that trumpet with two horns. We won't hear actual trumpets in the opera until the final act. The likely reason for Handel's choice here was that the story takes place in the days of chivalry and knights, when trumpets had a more archaic sound that was much more like horns. In Handel's day, in any case, the same pit musicians who played the horns undoubtedly also played the trumpets, the same way that the musicians who played the oboes likely also played the recorders and the flutes, which is why you don't necessarily ever hear those instrument sections playing together. Meanwhile, Polinesso hatches his evil plan. He persuades Ginevra's lady-in-waiting, Dalinda, to join him for a secret rendezvous later that night. He asks Dalinda to dress up in Ginevra's clothes and admit him to her lady's chambers. It seems like an awfully kinky idea, but Dalinda is blind with love for Polinesso. The prospect of an assignation with him is irresistible to her, even if she has to dress up as someone else to get it, and so she agrees. In moving from the first act to the second, we go from day to night, figuratively and literally. The second act opens with a brief orchestral prelude conjuring the rise of the moon on a starlit night. The violins trace the path of the moon's rising glow across an ascent of over 2 octaves as the basses move in the inverse direction, sinking downward again and again, falling away from the moon's fickle light. Thank you. one was about love and celebration in the daylight, mostly in sunny major keys. Act two is about loss and betrayal in the nighttime, mostly in melancholy minor keys. The acts are designed to be opposites of one another in a looking glass, and with this prelude, Handel reminds us that the light of the moon is merely the sun's pale reflection. Paulinesso succeeds in deceiving Ariodante and convincing him that Ginevra is untrue. In an aria that sits at the center of the opera, that is the opera's beating heart, Ariodante laments his lover's faithlessness and resolves to embrace death. Muted upper strings and pizzicato basses create a plush, heavy-hearted foundation, above which floats a plaintive obbligato for bassoons. It's a requiem for love. Scherza infida, Ariodante says, in grembo al drudo. Go play, faithless woman, in your lover's arms. Another composer, this moment could easily have been full of rage and vocal pyrotechnics, but Handel chooses a less obvious path, arguably ennobling Ariodante's sense of betrayal with unaffected expression and sincere pain. Unusually for Handel, and somewhat famously, there's no tempo marking in the score for this aria, which means it's open to a wide variety of different interpretations. You'll have to listen and decide for yourself whether you approve of Maestro Bickett's pacing. The fallout from Paulinesso's deception is fast and furious. The king receives word that Ariodante has leapt into the sea. Ginevra is denounced as an unchaste woman and blamed for her lover's death. Moreover, the law of Scotland at the time, according to the story, is that women deemed wanton or adulterous must be put to death. The act draws to a close with a forsaken Ginevra bemoaning her torments and welcoming death in a funereal aria full of haunting pauses and suspensions. Whereas Ariodante, for his big lament, was enveloped by the opulence of the full orchestra, Ginevra is accompanied by much gaunter forces, just unison violins and continuo. That's it. It's stark, spare, and harrowing. In the B section of the aria, that accompaniment drops even further to only the continuo, indicating the extent to which Ginevra is indeed all alone in the world. She falls asleep in a sequence of ballets depict her dreams. The dreams are both good and bad, and ultimately, they battle it out in a big ballet fugue finale. Ginevra wakens with a start, and the act ends with her singing four short lines of recitative in the only instance over all of Handel's operas where an act ends with recitative rather than an aria. At the start of the third act, Ariodante wanders aimlessly in a wild forest. Spoiler alert, he's not dead after all. Ariodante is taken aback to hear the cries of Dalinda, who's being attacked by henchmen of Paulinesso. after having used Dalinda for his own nefarious purposes, Polinesso plots to have her killed in an effort to silence her. Ariodante saves Dalinda from the assassins, and she unravels for him the many strands of Polinesso's treachery, putting us squarely on the path to the opera's resolution. The two rush off to the palace to save Ginevra. Needless to say, another spoiler, everything works out in the end. Polinesso gets his comeuppance, and Dalinda is pardoned by the king. After Dalinda's pardoning, Ariodante sings a flashy showpiece that celebrates the passing of night into day. You can hear the enormity of his happiness in this song by how ecstatically he elongates the word gioia with buoyant syncopations. He dispatches roulades up and down the musical staff with breathless brio. Just to give one example, listen here to how he twice sings E di gioia empie la terra, meaning, and with joy fills the earth. On the word gioia the second time around, he leaps all the way up to a high A, then blazes down two whole octaves to a low A. Encompassed in these few measures is the entirety of the role's musical range. Sure, it's about vocally showing off and competing with Farinelli, but it serves a dramatic purpose as well. It's also an expression of the range of emotional extremities that Ariodante has lived over the course of the story. After this big explosion of Ariodante's joy, all that's left is for the opera's lovers to be reconciled. But before our heroes are reunited, the second-ranking romantic couple takes center stage. It just so happens that Ariodante's brother, Lurcanio, is in love with lady-in-waiting Dalinda, even though she has spent the entire opera rebuffing him. So, quick review. Ariodante is loved by Ginevra. Ginevra is loved by Polinesso. Polinesso is loved by Dalinda. Dalinda is loved by Lurcanio, and Lurcanio is the brother of Ariodante. Trust me, it's much easier to follow in performance. Now that Polinesso is out of the picture, Lurcanio approaches Dalinda to woo her one last time. For their duet, Handel builds some very understandable hesitation and mistrust into the music. Lest we forget, Dalinda only just loved another man who tried to have her murdered. So, sure, might be a bit hard to believe that she's ready to commit herself to another guy. The two of them sing back and forth for quite some time without singing at the same time, which is always an important sign in opera. When the A section of the duet returns, listen for how Handel changes the accompaniment for each character's statement. Lurcanio is accompanied by the continuo, Dalinda by the violins. They're not even sharing the same orchestral forces in their music making, a sure indication that they have a ways to go before being a happy, harmonious couple. Ti spera e son contento no ti lama spera spera io già mi pento no ti Note how long it takes for them to sing together simultaneously. They only sing at the same time in the final moments of the duet, and even then, they don't sing the same words. It's not the most auspicious start to a lifetime together. The flashes of skepticism we detect in the Dalinda-Lurcanio duet are nowhere to be found in the final duet for Ginevra and Ariodante. These two are singing at the same time and sharing words from the get-go. The match, it would seem, is a good one. And this, despite the fact that Ariodante, on the flimsiest of pretenses, blamed Ginevra for being unfaithful, which caused her to be declared a harlot, renounced by her father, shunned by her community, imprisoned in her chambers, and very nearly executed. And this is a representation of what should happen. in a just and moral world. If ever you wonder why there's a Me Too movement, Ginevra and Dalinda can surely help show you why. That said, the world of Ariodante is also a world in which men who use falsetto and women who use chest voice and men who are emasculated and women who are cross-dressed all have the occasion to be seen and heard as noble, heroic, and desirable. Now that may well indeed be the best of all possible worlds. The music that you've heard here is generously furnished by Warner Classics and is available for purchase on iTunes. Lyrics commentaries are made possible through the generous support of the Patrick G. and Shirley Welsh Ryan Foundation in memory of their parents. I'm Derek Mattson, and I hope to see you at the opera.